up? Another episode of Ripple Effect Podcast. I'm your host, Ricky Verandas. Today we got ex-CIA John Kiriakou. Really interesting podcast. Really interesting story. He was one of the first people to expose the enhanced interrogation program for what it really was, which was a torture program, and end up doing 2 years in prison because of it. While in prison, really interesting, he actually used his CIA training and the methods and techniques that he learned while in the CIA to survive in prison. So basically got spies to work for him. He manipulated people. He did all types of things to just survive. And so he wasn't fucked with. And he goes into detail on our show about that. So really, really interesting. So we'll talk about his book. We talk about also, I think we talk about a little bit about the documentary Silenced, which he is one of the subjects in the documentary. It's three whistleblowers. They follow their lives. They show you how being a whistleblower and exposing these unethical things end up basically ruining their lives, lost their jobs, in many cases lost their pension and their money, ruined their families, everything. So it's really heart-wrenching, and I really highly recommend people to check it out. I believe it's still on Netflix and probably available everywhere you can find videos or films. So check that out. What else? This weekend, UFC 212. There's a pretty good chance we'll be doing a live Fight With Friends. If you guys don't know what Fight With Friends is, it's my version of Joe Rogan's Fight Companion. We watch the UFC event and we stream live. We hang out, we talk, we drink. Sometimes we drink little, sometimes we drink a lot. Sometimes we talk about the fight, sometimes we talk about everything else. So every show is a little different, but definitely tune in. If you guys want to send some questions, you can always tweet us while we're doing it live, or if you have any suggestions or anything like that. So please check that out. You can follow us on Twitter at RVTheory6. You can go to my YouTube channel, RVTheory6. And now I am also on Instagram, which I don't know if this social media overkill, but I figure it's a free way to get the word out and to share some of my journeys and things that are going on in my life, and one more place for free marketing. So why not? So everybody else is on it, and I figured I'd join too. So that's it. I'll see you guys on the next one, and peace. John.
Not too much. How are you doing?
Not bad. Can't complain. Thanks for being with me. Appreciate it.
Very happy to do it.
I've been a fan of yourself and a lot of just whistleblowers that I give a lot of credit to, because especially when I watched that movie Silence years ago. Oh, and it, actually, funny enough, I just kind of started watching it yesterday for a little bit, because I'm like, oh, let me see that film a little bit again, just to see if it reminds me of some stuff I could bring up to John. And then Peter Van Buren was in the credits, and Peter Van Buren was on yesterday, and I'm like, oh, that's I'm like, so it was pretty cool. I'm like, hey, Peter, I have John Kiriakou on tomorrow. I'm like, it's funny because I didn't know that you were part of that project. I think at the time when I watched the documentary, I wasn't familiar with Peter's work, but really just pulls at your heartstrings, because you see how it personally ruins people. And you know, I've been trying to get Thomas Drake on forever, and we go back and forth, and he's, you know, busy or something comes up or whatnot. But he's another guy that I've really wanted to talk to, because I think people need to hear these stories. I mean, so often they only see your faces and your names and hear like portions of your story on the news, on the media, but it's like just sliver, you know, a little sliver of the whole story, and they don't really get the perspective that you get from a documentary when they really see how not just yourself but your family's affected. I mean, in Thomas Drake's case, I mean, he went through a separation, I mean, lost his, you know, house or whatever. I mean, he just went through
it. Sure did.
Yeah.
He lost everything. Lost his pension, lost his family.
Yeah.
It was awful.
Yeah, I mean, at least Peter, he was one of those few whistleblowers that actually kept his pension, and you know, he ended up retiring and you know, end up at least, you know, hopefully it was a good thing. He got his pension and he retired with some money, and then wasn't completely just left out stranded. But when you hear stories like yourself, and you're looking for work anywhere and everywhere, and you're, you know, you go from with all these skills, this highly skilled, you know, what could be a highly skilled employee, you know, you're trying to find work at Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks or wherever they'll take you. And it's just, it's mind-blowing, because it's just, you know, the especially yourself, because hearing your story and how patriotic you were and how your heart was about, you know, doing the right thing. And that's kind of what motivated you to even get in this field of work. And then the same people that you were supposed to defend and you know, turn on you. It's just.
Yeah, they do. They turn on you. Yeah. And not just turn on you, but they turn on you to the point of ruination. You know, it's one thing to say, okay, I disagree with Kiriakou. I disagree with what he did. It's another thing to say, I'm not going to rest until Kiriakou is completely ruined. You know?
Yeah, it's crazy. But for people who aren't familiar with your story and or know your name, know portions of it, but how did you get into working for the CIA? What motivated you to want to get in that field of work? I know are you a Greek immigrant, or your parents were born in Greece?
My grandparents were Greek immigrants. All four of them came from the island of Rhodes. And to hear my grandfather, my dad's father, tell the story, you know, Franklin Roosevelt was personally waiting for him at Ellis Island with a passport and a job at a steel mill in Pittsburgh. I'm exaggerating, of course, but my grandparents were so honored to be in this country and so grateful to become American citizens that they always instilled in us, both their children and grandchildren, the notion of public service, that this country had been so good to us that we needed to pay it back somehow. And so when I was in college and grad school, I really only considered jobs in public service.
Really? So I get it, because I'm an immigrant myself. My kids are actually the first generation born here. I'm from Portugal, and same thing. You know, it's like you do get incredible opportunity here, and you do. But it always makes me wonder, because I don't know if you, like my parents, for example, they came to this country. They were farmers in northern Portugal, and they came to this country. And, you know, we always have this idea, this American dream idea of if you work hard, you'll have opportunity, you'll accomplish things. But when you really look at the statistics, there's not a whole lot of people that go from like poor to rich. You know, like it's not as that rags to riches, you know, kind of fantasy. It really doesn't exist or doesn't happen as often as we think. Like, for example, my parents, they saved every penny. Like, I remember being a kid and just having, even when my parents came over here, me and my brother stayed in Portugal for a year, because to come to a country that you didn't speak the language, you didn't write, you didn't do any of that stuff, to find work, get settled in, and have, at that time, you know, me and my brother were like 3 years old. We're twins, actually, and we're 3 years old. And to have two twin boys, it's like it would have been impossible. So a lot of my relatives that were in America is like, hey, listen, unfortunately, you're going to have to leave the kids in Europe, and you're going to have to come on your own and really just get settled in, which I couldn't even imagine the sacrifice that is.
I couldn't imagine. My dad's father was one of 18 children.
Wow.
Including three sets of twins. And, you know, people were starving to death. And so he had two brothers who were living in Canonsburg, Pennsylvania, who had emigrated several years earlier. So when he turned 20, he got on a ship in steerage and made the trek to the States, went to Canonsburg, Pennsylvania, just south of Pittsburgh. His brothers told him that there was plenty of work in the mills. That was true. And he worked from 1920 to 1930. He saved something like $10,000. I put in my first book. I think it was $10,000, which in today's money is like $225,000. And then went back to Greece, bought some land, which is still in the family, and got married. But then one of his brothers wrote him a letter and said, hey, they're going to change the law over here. And so if you want your wife to be an American, you're going to have to come back now. And so he literally just walked out of the fields. He left his tools in the fields and got my grandmother. They packed their things. They came to the States, arriving in February of 1931. And then he never left the States ever again, from 1931 until he died in 78.
Oh, so he never went back to Greece?
He never went back to Greece. No.
It's never. Funny.
My grandmother used to go back every 5 or 6 years to visit relatives, but my grandfather never went back. He said he never had a desire, that the country had never given him anything, and that his life was in America.
I kind of get that, because there are people like that that I know, Portuguese people, and I live in a town called Ludlow, and there's a lot of Polish and Portuguese immigrants here. And same thing, you meet guys that grew up their whole lives in Poland or Portugal, come to America and never go back. And it's always like, you know, it's like, really, you don't have any urge to go back? And kind of similar idea where just like you said, they were struggling there. There wasn't a lot of work. It's like a lot of, I mean, that's the beautiful thing about Europe is that that's why I think people are so cultured there, where, you know, my parents, they worked in Switzerland. I have a lot of family that migrated to France because looking for work. And you meet so many people from different backgrounds, different religions, different whatever, and because of it, I think it's much harder to dehumanize people, and it's much harder to look at, you know, other cultures and being and you know, for example, I was talking about this with Peter yesterday. I think because we live in this bubble in America, and if you don't leave this country, if you don't travel, then it's much easier to look at them as the other, as
right,
you know, and. I think when you do leave, and the amazing thing about Europe, you know, you go to Greece, you go to Portugal, wherever you go in Europe, people speak their language, your language, and like two other languages. You know, everybody speaks multiple languages. And I think you connect with people because of it. And so I think that definitely is a cool thing about Europe, is that people do know, like, everybody has friends from different backgrounds, different cultures. Here we do too, you know, because it is a melting pot. But, you know, a lot of people are kind of more disconnected from, you know, where they're from or where their family's from. And which I always find interesting during like the World Cup, all of a sudden people are super patriotic again about their ancestry. You know, it's like all of a sudden I'm rooting for Italy because I have an Italian last name, or I'm rooting for Greece because I have a Greek last name. So it's pretty cool. But so you joined the CIA. I know most of my listeners have probably, and including yourself, have probably watched the movie The Recruit. How much of you know, how much of that is like similar, like the training and stuff like that?
You know, I saw that movie in the theater with five CIA friends. We all went together to watch that movie. And the first half of that movie was 100% accurate.
Really?
It was just, you know, we were actually shocked. I remember my friends like commenting during the movie, like, wow, somebody's leaking about training, because this is spot on. And then the second half of the movie, it just like fell apart and was so, you know, from the realm of fantasy that the movie just ended up not working for me. But the first half, I mean, the only thing that wasn't 100% accurate is they didn't beat us in training like they beat him. I mean, they come close, but they don't actually beat you. Otherwise, the first half of that movie was great.
Really? Yeah. I always wondered, because people watch that movie and I think it's a great recruiting tool, because there's, you know, I mean, it shouldn't be, because obviously you're getting, like you said, you're getting beat and stuff. But I remember, you know, my girlfriend at the time, you know, now she's my wife. But when we watched that movie, she's like, oh, my God, I would love to do that CIA. You know, it's like this idea of like spy, you know, being a spy and your whole life's a secret. But I always feel like it's, in a way, it's very sexy from the outside looking in. But there are a lot of sacrifices that have to be made, like having to kind of, you know, not tell your closest friends and relatives any of your most inner thoughts and what's going on in your life, and constantly living a secret. I mean, how much of your life was like that, and how much of that did affect your psyche in regards to feeling like you're living a lie?
Your whole life is like that. You can't tell anybody what you really do, even your spouse. And that's why the agency encourages agency romances, because you're both cleared and at least you can have a conversation when you're laying in bed at night. You know, the CIA has, excuse me, the highest divorce rate of any governmental entity. And it's because of that stress, the stress of having to live two lives, and in some cases more than two lives. So yeah, it's fun and it's exciting. It's the greatest job I ever had in my life, but it cost me my first marriage. And at the same time, you're confronted with these moral and ethical dilemmas that are not easy. And in fact, well, in my case, and in the case of, you know, Tom Drake and Peter Van Buren and others, it's life-changing.
Yeah, well, it cost you your first marriage. Was that and just from working for the CIA, or was it a whistleblowing thing? It was just from strictly.
It was from working for the CIA. Yep.
So it's just strictly.
She was a ballet instructor. And as soon as I switched to counterterrorism operations, everything had to go clandestine. And so, you know, I had five different cell phones. I kept them in a locked den. And one of the phones would would ring at 11 o'clock at night. I would leave to do a 2 or 3 hour surveillance detection route. I would do my emergency meeting, do a 2 hour surveillance detection route back home, get there at, 6 o'clock in time to take a shower and get ready for work. And she wanted to know, what was her name? Where did you meet her? And I'd be like, honey, you're going to have to take my word for it. I was working.
Yeah.
And she didn't take my word for it.
Because really, if you were cheating, that's exactly what you would do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Meeting in the abandoned parking lot of the Athens Yacht Club, or, one time I actually had to climb into a garbage dumpster and wait for a guy to throw a bag of documents in. And I got back home and she accused me again of cheating on her. And I said, do I smell like I've been cheating on you? Seriously? You really think I've been cheating on you, coming home smelling like this? But I couldn't tell her what I was doing.
Yeah, that must be so difficult, because especially when you know that, and I can see from, I always try to see things from the other person's perspective, even if I don't agree with them, but I can see how it could be really hard too, just from her perspective, like taking your word for it. The mind plays tricks on you. It's very easy to start getting paranoid and start, that's why I always tell friends of mine, I'm like, listen, you can meet a girl with flaws, but if you don't trust her, it's never going to work. Like other flaws, yeah, you can work on those things. You can accept them. You can kind of work on them, improve on them. But if you don't have trust, there's nothing. There's no fixing that, because the second you guys aren't together, your brain's playing tricks on you. Like, why didn't he call me back yet? Well, why did you take so long to text message me? So he told me he was going to be here, and somebody told me he saw him over here. And it's like, all it is just this paranoia that's just really creating what you think is happening.
Right.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. And that's the demise of so many marriages in the CIA. They just can't survive that not knowing and that mistrust.
It makes sense, because I actually have a cousin. She's my first cousin, and she's a retired FBI, and her husband's also retired FBI. And it makes perfect sense. They met at the bureau. But let me say that they're still very good at not saying anything, because we'll have family get-togethers and I'll just start grilling them about stuff, and they're just like, oh, we really don't know what's going on. And there's probably some truth to that. I'm sure the CIA is very similar, where it's everything's like need to know basis. So
even if you're really compartmentalized.
Yeah. So even if you're really good friends with somebody, or in this case, dating or marrying somebody, unless they have any reason to know what you're doing, you don't tell them, they don't tell you, and that's how you keep things secret. That's why a lot of times when you hear these stories about, like, well, how would they keep that secret, it's like, well, they do, and often and people,
they do they keep everything secret. It's just the nature of the job.
I mean, you look at like Area 51, I mean, there's tons of speculations on what happens. Nobody really knows what's going on. People bring in scientists or whatever, researchers, and they go there, they do their one specific job, they leave, nobody knows what anybody else is doing. The Manhattan Project, that was hidden from the public for a long time. So when people say, oh, how do they get away with this? Somebody would talk, and a lot of times when you do your research, you realize people do talk, like yourself and others, people do talk, but a lot of times that voice gets muffled, and people, the media will suppress that information. So to get back on your story, so you end up joining the CIA. Did you, before you joined the CIA, did you have a idea of what you thought it was like? Did you think it was going to be something like The Recruit, or did you not kind of went in with kind of
no. The only connection that I had in any way with the CIA was friends from college or grad school whose parents worked at the CIA or who had graduated and had gone into analysis. So I was pretty certain that if I were to end up at the CIA, it would be in analysis, not in operations. And my first wife, she just did not want to live overseas. And because my area of expertise was the Middle East, she especially didn't want to live overseas. So when I went through the process and finally got an offer in analysis, I snatched it up, and she was happy about it too.
Nice. So, and then you're working for the CIA. It was typically what you thought it was going to be? Did you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was just so exciting. And I my first assignment was Iraq. I was Saddam Hussein's biographer. I was the Iraq analyst in the Office of Leadership Analysis. And so just at the point where I feel like I know what I'm doing and know what I'm talking about, Iraq invades Kuwait. And the next day, you know, the morning of August 2nd, 1991, I find myself in the Oval Office with the president, the vice president, the national security advisor, the director of the CIA, my boss, and me. And then the president asks a question and everybody turns and looks at me. And I thought, oh my God, my friends, if they could see this, nobody would believe this. Like, I couldn't believe it myself. But then I realized, you know, this isn't just something cool and fun. This is really, really important. And the stakes are very high. And I can't get this wrong. And so the first Gulf War kind of made me a star there. I ended up going into full-time Arabic training a couple of years later. And then I was the economic officer at the American Embassy in Bahrain for 2 years. I was on loan to the State Department. Came back to headquarters in 96, went back to work on Iraq. And then I just got so bored because it was clear to me that the Clinton administration had no real Iraq policy. And so that was when I switched to counterterrorism operations. Hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting. What made you intrigued with the whole just Middle East? And was it just because of all the conflict there? And
you know what it was? When I was in high school, that's when the Iranian Revolution took place. And 52 Americans were taken hostage and held for 444 days. And I was just obsessed with the Iran hostage crisis. You know, that's when ABC News created Nightline. The purpose of Nightline in the beginning was just to give a daily update of the Iran hostage crisis.
Really?
And it morphed into a standalone news show. So I would stay up every night, watch Nightline, get all the latest. I was just fascinated by the whole thing and decided that whatever it is I ended up doing, I wanted it to have something to do with the Middle East.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's funny how little people know in America of the Middle East. I tell people all the time, I'm like, you know how many Muslims you probably interact with on a daily basis, and you don't know they're Muslim, and because they don't look like the Muslim that they're selling you on the media, you know, the crazy guy with a rifle in the back of a truck, you know, it's like, it's just, we're so disconnected from other cultures and stuff, and I think that we have this huge issue where we do dehumanize, especially Muslims, you know, and now, I mean, not to I'm not talking about Islamophobia so much, but really, and when you learn history, and I talked about this with Peter Van Buren yesterday, you know, the fall of the Ottoman Empire and how, you know, I've had a lot of historians on, you talk to them, it's like, it's very hard to understand what's going on today without going all the way back to World War One, creating countries that shouldn't have been countries, you know, and all the things from, you know, in the, what was it, 52 or 53, when we took down the first democratically elected president of Iran, like all these things. So with the hostage crisis, you know, people know about the hostage crisis, but it's like, a lot of people don't know about the, you know, the coup in the 50s, you know, and it's like, so we've had our hand in the Middle East for a long time. And
we did that for British Petroleum.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it was, the Brits came to us in the early 50s when Mohammad Mossadegh was elected prime minister of Iran. And the whole point of it was that the British wanted to keep their oil. They were essentially stealing from the Iranian people. And so they talked Kermit Roosevelt, who was Teddy Roosevelt's son and a senior CIA officer. They talked him into overthrowing Mossadegh, and we did. And our relations with the Iranians have never recovered. I mean, that's over a half a century ago, and we've never recovered.
Yeah, it's crazy. That's why history is so important, because you kind of understand how you got to this point when you follow the road backwards. You know, you follow the stream upstream, and you kind of see where it's all coming from. And I think... Yeah. I think it's easy just to kind of look at things and be like, oh, they hate us because we're American and we're free, you know?
They hate our freedom. I hate when I hear that. Nothing could be more ridiculous.
Yeah, actually, most of them love our culture. I mean, music, you know, American, I mean, that's basically our biggest export, is like our entertainment. It's like our music, our shows, our celebrities, you know? So it's, I mean, it's so ridiculous when people say that they hate us because we're free. And I mean, it's a great little just kind of a way of convincing people, like, yeah, that seems simple enough. That's why they hate us. And you can digest that, and you don't have to read any history books to understand it anymore. But yeah, I mean, everything from, it is crazy. But historically, we, a lot of these countries, we have had a hand, I mean, in Iraq, Afghanistan, I mean, all the way to giving weapons to money to Bin Laden through the ISI in Pakistan to help them fight the Soviets. And like I was telling Peter yesterday, you know, and a big part of that too was I remember reading that a way of motivating bin Laden at that time was basically describing the Soviets as these anti-Muslim, anti-religious people, you know, these communists. Yeah. And now it's like, oh, look, these are religious extremists. But at the time, it's like when they're working for us, then it's okay for them to be religious extremists. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Yes, yes.
There was, I know, in I don't know if it was an interview I saw with you or in the documentary where you talked about meeting, I think at the time it was what they thought was like the third top leader of Al-Qaeda. I think it right when one of the guys that got detained and the one that I
captured, Abu Zubaydah.
Yes. Yeah. And I remember you talking about how most of these guys haven't read the Quran. They're young guys that just don't have options. I mean, I always use the example, Mike, why do you think there's gangs in poor areas of the U.S. and cities and stuff like that? Because when there is no options, when there is no other place to go, there's no way out of where you are, like, it's really easy to recruit people into getting together, becoming, you know, a gang, becoming a group, feeling a part of something, a part of a family. I'm like, so a lot of these countries, that's why. I'm like, we destabilize them. They're a mess. I'm like, and it's the best way of recruiting people. I'm like, if everybody was working and had safe environments and good schools and paved roads, I'm like, you think anybody would want to join a terrorist group? You know what?
You know, I say this in interviews all the time. The answer to this whole terrorism problem in the Middle East is not sexy and it's not quick. It's education and public works projects. Because if people have an education and a job skill and the infrastructure in their countries to spur on economic development, then there's no reason to turn to extremism. But that's not a quick fix, and people don't want to talk about stuff like that.
Yeah, but from your opinion, do you feel like stabilizing the Middle East is even a concern? Like, do you think it's ever their true intentions, or is it just this idea that we're sold so we can constantly get involved and take resources?
I think people really do want a stable Middle East because it's better for business. I mean, we'll make far, far more money trading with stable Middle Eastern countries than we would just selling arms or you know, war is very expensive. I remember even during the first Gulf War, President Bush being utterly shocked that it was costing us something like $10 million a day to be in the Gulf. Well, it's 10 times that now, and we can't afford that. So yeah, I think people really do, when I say people, I mean leaders. I think they really do want stability and peace in the Middle East, if only for selfish reasons of trade and business.
But I mean, for example, like Peter Van Buren's story about going to Iraq, seeing all the private contractors that are making all, you know, most of the money was going to. I mean, they all have lobbyists, they have a lot of pull, they have a lot of influence. It almost seems like keeping things destabilized and keeping things a mess only justifies more spending. I mean, it's always easier to get the public to spend money on military and defense when we feel unsafe, when we feel like, you know, this idea, you know, we talked about September 11th and when the anthrax thing happened, it's like it was just one more thing to add to us feeling unsafe. Like so everybody just felt like we had to do something. They weren't sure what we needed to do, but it was the best way of getting people to, you know, when people are afraid, they're making knee-jerk reactions emotionally. They're not really thinking things out, and that's how they could connect Iraq to September 11th, even though there was no connection, and get people to be for invading it. And you know, when you look at Iraq, for example, like, do you really feel like there was ever true intentions or look at Libya now. Look at, you know, we talked about Iran in the 50s.
Yeah. No, but see, this is a bigger problem in the overall policy, and that is that we don't have an overall policy. You know, it was as though I was working on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at the time of the Arab Spring, and it was as though Obama and Clinton and even John Kerry over at the committee just got caught up in the euphoria of change and people power and didn't give 5 seconds of thought to what happens afterwards. And so what happened afterwards was chaos and anarchy, because if there's no plan for a post-revolutionary era, there's no plan to institute a democratic government or something that, even if it's not democratic, if it's at least representative and peace-loving, then you're gonna have the situation devolve into chaos. And that's what happened in Libya. That's what happened in Syria. It's what was happening in Egypt before the military junta took power. So all in all, we're far worse off now than we were in 2009 before these uprisings began.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree. So you're working for the CIA. Things are, you know, going pretty well. When was the change of heart? When was the change? When did things start looking like the intentions of the agency you thought were pure and good maybe weren't so?
About 6 months after 9/11. You know, 9/11 was so traumatic that changes that I thought were temporary in response to the attack, I later learned were not temporary. They were permanent, and that the CIA leadership had no intention of going back to the way things were in the old days. And that's why the CIA now has transitioned into a paramilitary organization, or even a cyber espionage organization. You know, the original point of the CIA was to recruit spies to steal secrets, and then to analyze those secrets to provide the best possible intelligence for the policymakers. And that's not the purpose of the CIA anymore. The purpose of the CIA is to hunt people down and to kill them if we think that they could someday pose a threat to the United States. And that's just not what I signed on for.
And what made you realize that? What specifically? Was it the, you know, the exposure?
It was the torture program.
The torture, yeah.
It was the torture program. You know, because of my own personal experience, I have trouble complimenting the FBI. But if there's one thing that the FBI is really, really great at, it's interrogations. And the FBI was collecting actionable intelligence from Abu Zubaydah that saved American lives and disrupted attacks. The CIA then took over only because it was a bureaucratic pissing match, not for any other reason, and began torturing him. And the rest is an ignominious history. The CIA was wrong. They were wrong legally. They were wrong ethically. They were wrong morally. And I realized that this was not an organization that I wanted to be a part of anymore.
Yeah, there's a documentary called Doctors of the Dark Side, and I think it's about are you familiar with it?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, the guys who kind of designed the enhanced interrogation techniques, and mm-hmm. I believe they're like psychologists, right, or some type of.
They were clinical psychologists. They reverse engineered the military's SEER program, and used it to as the basis of their torture program. They charged the American taxpayers $81 million for it, which they collected. And again, the rest is history.
Yeah, it's crazy how recklessly we spend our money. That's why I always say, I'm like, anytime a politician says, oh, we need to raise taxes, I'm like, no, we just need to, I mean, they need to do what like you and I do. If money gets tight, we have to cut corners and balance our own budgets. Like, how politicians never have to do that. They just ask for more money. It's just, it's ridiculous. They don't have an income problem. They have a spending problem.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Absolutely true.
So when did you decide, okay, so you end up, you're working for the CIA, you end up obviously having this change of heart because you saw what was going on. When did you decide to go public with it?
Well, I kept my mouth shut for 5.5 years. I was one of 14 people who were asked if we wanted to be what they said, what they called trained in enhanced interrogation techniques. I was the only one who said no, that I had a moral objection to it. But I kept my mouth shut just because, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. It's part of the job. You mind your own business and you do as you're told. So I left the agency in 2004. Still kept my mouth shut. And so in late 2007, Brian Ross of ABC News approached me and said that a source of his had said that I had tortured Abu Zubaydah. I said that was absolutely untrue. I was the only person who was kind to Abu Zubaydah. Well, you're welcome to come on the show and defend yourself. So I foolishly did. But in the meantime, the president had made a couple of very provocative statements, just out and out denying that we were torturing any prisoners. And I knew that was a lie. So I decided to do Brian Ross's show, and I decided that whatever he asked me, I was going to tell the truth. And so I did. I said that the CIA was torturing its prisoners. I said that torture was official U.S. government policy, not the result of a rogue, as the president had said. And I said that the program had been personally approved by the president himself. So,
and you went public.
I let the cards fall where they may.
And you said that because you assumed that a lot of that information was ready to public knowledge, because some people
were. It actually was public knowledge. In 2005, Human Rights Watch published a report saying that the CIA was torturing its prisoners. In 2006, Amnesty International did the same thing. And in 2007, it was the International Committee of the Red Cross. So I was the first current or former CIA officer to confirm it, but I just didn't think that that was that big of a deal. And I was wrong. It actually was a very big deal.
So after that, then did the CIA contact you? And I mean,
oh, no, not at all. What they did is within 24 hours, they filed what's called a crimes report against me with the FBI, saying that I had illegally leaked classified information. So the FBI investigated me from December of 2007 to December of 2008, and then closed the case and determined that I had not committed a crime. So 3 weeks later, Barack Obama is inaugurated, and the CIA secretly asked the Justice Department to reopen the case against me. I had no idea they had done that. And the Justice Department then secretly investigated me for three more years. And then in January of 2012, I was charged with five felonies, including three counts of espionage that came out of that that interview.
Wow. Yeah, I think Obama charged more people with espionage than like the history of the United States.
Yeah, three times more than all previous presidents combined.
Yeah, that's crazy, because that was a big part of his website. I remember talking about, you know, supporting whistleblowers and protecting them and all that stuff. And then he completely retracted. That's why it seems everything just seems like theater. It doesn't matter who's in power. Yeah. The policy doesn't change that much. But you being behind the curtain and kind of working behind the curtain and kind of seeing what really happens in closed door conversations, there's a lot of people who are influencing what, I mean, by the time we get information, by the time we get, or whatever they want us to believe is accurate information, there's a lot of influencing people from, I'm sure, people that represent corporations, people who represent think tanks. And I mean, so how much, like, because we always have, from the outside looking in, somebody like myself, who's just a typical civilian, we wonder, what happens to a person when they become president? Is it like the Bill Hicks joke that they become?
You know, that's a good question, and I think I have an answer. I think that he didn't change once he became president. There was a book written by Mark Halperin and John Heilman called Double Down about the 2012 election. It was a sequel to their book about the 2008 election, New York Times number one bestseller. And Obama agreed to sit for an interview for that book. And he said two things that were just so shocking to me that they still stand out. First, he said, very matter-of-factly, I never said I was a liberal. And man, nothing could have been more true. He never said he was liberal, and indeed he was not a liberal. And then speaking about the drone program, he said, I never had any idea that I would be so good at killing people, which was also true. And that's not a progressive talking.
Yeah.
That's a neocon or a neoliberal.
Yeah. No, that's like, remember that speech where he talked about, what was it, the Jonas Brothers, and, you know, dating his daughters, and he's like,
yeah,
oh, you know, I just got one word for you, drones, or something like that. And it's,
yeah,
and he was
not
just
funny. Kind of,
yeah, he was just making a joke about it. And it's like, you read stories from, I think it was like Vice.com that had like a story about how in Yemen, they're afraid of cleared skies because, you know, because that's when the drones come out. I mean, it's scary, right, man. I mean, to live like that, to live in that type of terror and panic and anxiety, And then the fact that when you research how inaccurate they are, there's actually a good app on your phone that I actually have it called Metadata. And it's this, have you heard about it? It's a completely free app. And what he actually, I think Apple like shut him down for a while, but now he's back. And, but you basically, it gives you updates on every drone attack and it gives you a map. And it's like, I do it. I downloaded it for the purpose of like, I wanted to see how often this was happening and how often this wasn't reported. Yeah. And this, you know, to zoom into the Middle East, and obviously a lot of it's in the isolated areas. And it's just, it's crazy that people are dying. And then it tells you like, you know, four boys died and a girl, you know, it's like, like this is happening every day. And when you wonder why they hate us, it's not because of our freedoms, because this second you kill, like I remember right before a podcast, I remember reading this story about how we accidentally killed a wedding party. And I think it also was in Yemen.
Not just one. We used to drone wedding parties all the time. If the drone operator saw a tall Arab looking guy wearing white, we would drone them.
Really? Why?
That happened a half a dozen times.
And why is that? Why specifically wedding parties? Was it just because
they figured it was bin Laden? He'd been invited to a wedding and this is our chance and we're going to get him.
That is crazy. And I say all the time, like, those people who are at those wedding parties, those survivors, those people will forever hate the country that just killed all their closest loved ones and relatives. I'm like, if you think they hate us because of our freedoms and you ignore that, then you're delusional. I mean, yeah. It's obvious you're creating terrorists, you know, and I think,
yeah,
you know,
there's been, true.
Yeah, I mean, you're creating, who wouldn't, it's no different than if a Soviet drone came over my house, blew up my house, killed my two kids and my wife. What do you think?
Yes.
My life goal will be, you know, to get revenge. It's no different than a thousand Hollywood movies that have, a family that gets taken or some gang that kills the wife or the kid or whatever. And then the father wants revenge. I'm like, you're really creating those real scenarios, those real circumstances.
Yes.
And it's scary. I mean, I think it's really easy. And I think we're so detached from wars, too. We hear about it. It's not like Vietnam where people were seeing pictures and there's real investigative journalism and people were protesting because they knew what was going on. But, you know, even during the Bush administration, the idea that you couldn't take pictures of the caskets, you couldn't, you know, it's like we have to completely suppress the public from knowing what's truly going on. That stuff bothered the crap out of me because I'm like, if people don't see what war is, we hear the three-lettered word, we know, you know, we kind of know what it means, but we're not seeing it. So I'm going to work. Yeah. I'm going to work at the same time. I bring my kids to the park. I go to the mall with my family. Like, we do all the same things. My life doesn't change. So it's like, oh, who gives a shit that we're in a war? If we are or we aren't, my life doesn't change. Who cares? But if people actually saw, you know, the dead bodies, that's why when they had that that picture of that Syria boy who got washed up to sea. And
yes.
I mean,
that's why it was so powerful.
Oh my God. And as a parent, like I'm assuming before I had kids, it probably would be powerful. But as a parent, that just, I mean, it breaks your heart. I mean, you see something like that and it's just like, you just picture your, you know, that could be your kid. That could be, you know, and that's the thing, you know, when you travel, you realize like, we have so many similarities. I've had Mariana Venzeller on, who she had this show called Breaking Borders on the Travel Channel, and she would go to places like Palestine and the border of the U.S. and Mexico and all these places where people didn't get along, and take two people from each side of the argument, sit them down. She'd bring a chef, because the best way of bringing people together is food. and he would make food from both cultures and whatnot, and then sit them down and get them to kind of small talk and eventually bring up some of these topics, you know, why they dislike each other. And you realize before they get talking about that specific thing that they don't maybe agree on, which is, you know, if it's a Mexican and a Texan and it's like, oh, you know, whatever, then, or, you know, somebody from Palestine and somebody Jewish, before you talk about that one specific topic, all the other things they talk about, they're just fine. And they have everything in common. They talk about their kids. They talk about their family. They talk about, you know, just sports or, you know, soccer or whatever. And you realize that they have so much more in common than they do not in common. And I think that's what we have to kind of do a better job of understanding. One of my good friends just married a Chinese girl. He met her here, and then she moved back to China. He went there to visit her, and then they fell in love, and then they end up getting married, and now they're both here and whatnot. And you know, it's funny because it's like, she talks about how in America, it's almost like we think every Chinese person is this communist Chinese person who, you know, and it's like you meet her and she's much more knowledgeable about history and even some American history than a lot of Americans are. They know much more about what's going on in the rest of the world than what a lot of Americans do. And like I told Peter yesterday, it almost seems like America is like a mild version of North Korea. Like if you live in this country and you don't leave this country and you only watch news of this country, you're constantly being sold propaganda and you really don't have a grip and understanding of what's going on in the rest of the world.
And it's going to be the demise of our democracy. You know, it really is.
And when you say that, everybody talks about how every empire eventually falls. Do you think that is going to be the demise of the empire?
I believe that we need to get our act together, both domestically and globally. We shouldn't be the world's policeman. We shouldn't be the arbiter of truth and justice overseas. We should not impose democracy on countries that have no historical basis in democratic political systems. You know, we should help other countries in economic development and in trade and in rule of law. And I think the world would be a better place for it.
Yeah, and I think there's a huge issue when there's people in America who are living paycheck to paycheck, and yet we're sending money for countries that most people can't find on a map for reasons we don't really understand. And, you know, it's like I told Peter yesterday, it's like feeding your neighbor's kids and letting your kids starve. You know, we're not helping people here yet. You know, we have to help this country first, then, you know, if we have some extra resources, then you help other people. But we can't just use all our and this is what makes me think, this goes back to the question I asked you, this is what makes me think that their purpose really is like just really, I mean, all these private contractors, KBR, Halliburton, all these private, you know, Lockheed Martin, these guys have such influence on foreign policy and such influence on what's going on. I mean, how much of that did you see just, you know, when you talking about foreign policy and why we're getting involved in certain countries and not others and whatnot? How many people behind the scenes? You know, we look at the president, we think he's making all his decisions, and you know, but how much of people behind the curtain are actually having influence on what, you know, why we're in Syria and why we're in all these countries we probably shouldn't be in?
Well, I think one of the things that almost no Americans understand is the power and authority of the National Security Advisor. You know, we like to think that it's the Secretary of State who makes foreign policy. It's not the Secretary of State. It's the National Security Advisor. And the National Security Advisor is not elected and not confirmed by the U.S. Senate. It's an appointed position, and he or she answers to no one but the president himself. So, I mean, what do you do? How do you exercise oversight over something like that? Congress has to step in, but they don't. That's an ongoing beef that I have. And that's the utter failure of the congressional oversight committees to actually oversee anything.
Yeah, and the fact that we've been in plenty of wars without actually getting Congress's approval also. You know, I think what the last time we've actually declared war, you know, legally was
December 8th, 1941.
Yeah, that's insane. I mean, it's just, it's this idea of war on terror is a great way of just continuously being in a war, because who are you fighting? You're not fighting a enemy. You're not fighting a country. You're fighting a tactic, a technique. I mean, I don't know what to call it, but it's just, it's not a thing that exists that you can quantify and say, okay, we won this battle. Now we can stop funding drones and military companies and all this stuff. So it's scary. So you end up eventually exposing or I'm guessing that interview would eventually end up getting you locked up. Was it specifically that interview that you did?
Yeah. And it was that interview.
And then you end up doing time, and your new book, Doing Time Like a Spy, really interesting because how a lot of these techniques that you learned from working for the CIA, you actually used in prison to maintain. And I asked you a question like, how different was the CIA than you thought it was when you before you joined it? Well, how different was prison before you actually got there? Was it what you assumed, or was it very different?
Well, I thought that I was going to spend my time in a minimum security work camp because that's what the judge had ordered and the prosecutors had agreed to. So when I got to the prison, I turned myself in. I said, "Hi, I'm John Kiriakou. I'm here to turn myself in at 11 o'clock. And the CO, the corrections officer, began leading me around to the back of the actual prison, which is across the street from the camp. And I said, no, I'm supposed to be in the camp across the street. And the guy kind of chortled and said, "Not according to my paperwork, you're not." And so I said to myself, "Take it easy. There's nothing you can do." Because, you know, if you raise a ruckus, you're just going to go straight to solitary. Well, it took me 5 days before I got access to a phone, and I called my attorney and I said, "Hey, they put me in the actual prison with the murderers and the pedophiles and the drug kingpins. What do I do?" And he said, "Oh, wow. Well, we can file a motion, but it'll take 2 years before we get a hearing and you'll be home by then." "I'm sorry," he said, "you're just going to have to tough it out." And so it was that conversation that made me realize that I was going to have to rely on my training, that I had lived in worse places than Loretto, Pennsylvania. I had dealt with more dangerous people than the people I was encountering in Loretto, Pennsylvania. And so, you know, I picked myself up by my bootstraps and said, "We might as well get started."
So what techniques, what specific skills, what did seem to work? What seemed to help you survive, make friends, not, I mean, was your purpose to make friends, not make friends?
No.
Were you trying to?
No one should go to prison to make friends. Although I made some friends.
Well, I mean, for survival reasons. Like, in other words, like, you make friends because you know they'll protect you.
Well, I guess it's not that black and white. You make strategic alliances rather than friends. And I'll give you an example. The only thing that the cop said to me as he was processing me in was that if someone came into your cell uninvited, that was an act of aggression. And I would have to defend myself. So sure enough, I'm there for 2 hours and two neo-Nazis come in to my room, just walk right in. One had an enormous swastika that took up the entire front half of his neck. And so I jumped up, I put up my fists, I said, "What do you want?" And the guy says, "Take it easy. Are you the new guy?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Are you a fag?" I said, "No." "Are you a rat?" I said, "No, I didn't have anybody in my case. I'm not a rat." "Are you a chomo?" I said, "I don't know what that means." And he says, "Chomo, child molester." I said, "No, I'm not a child molester." "Okay," he says, "you can sit with the Aryans in the cafeteria." And I thought, all right, well, I guess I'm with the Aryans now. And then about 4 days later, two like totally knotted, muscle-bound African-American guys come in. Again, just walk right into my room. And one of them's holding a newspaper. Turned out to be the Nation of Islam newspaper. And again, I jumped up and I put my fists up. And he goes, "Hey, take it easy. Are you the CIA guy?" I said, "Yeah, so?" And he said, he like gingerly hands me the paper. And he says, "Reverend Farrakhan says you're a hero of the Muslim people. We just wanted to tell you you're not going to have any trouble with us." I said, "Oh, all right, thank you." And then in my original cell, four of my five cellmates were members of a myriad of Mexican drug gangs. And one of them asked me, "Are you educated?" And I said, "Yeah, I am." And he said, "Would you write an appeal to my judge to try to help me get out of here?" So I said, "Sure." So I wrote this appeal. He asked me, "How much do I owe you?" I said, "You don't owe me anything. I have money coming in from the outside. I don't need anything. I'm happy to do it." So he put the word out among all the Mexican gangs that I was a good guy. And so I never had any problems with anybody. And then finally, it was the Italians that adopted me in prison. It was the Italians to whom I was closest. They were my closest friends. I ate with them. I hung out with them. I exercised with them. And once word got around that I was with the Italians, then it was easy. It was easy after that.
Well, you do look a little Italian.
Yeah, Greeks, Italians, we're all the same.
Yeah, the Europeans, yeah, all the dark features, yeah. But so you didn't have any issues. So I end up seeming like it, a lot of the stuff kind of fell in place and worked out for itself. You didn't have to do too much, right?
Right, yeah, true.
And so once you're in there, what did you use any of the, I mean, to, did you ever end up having issues with anybody, or was?
A couple of times. And I go into this in great detail in the book. I won't spoil it for your listeners, but there were a couple of times when I used these 20 rules that I write about to really mess people up. You know, I was nasty. I was aggressive. I was difficult, and I got what I wanted. And then there was one time where I nearly lost my temper, and it was the Italians that reminded me of the rules, and they ended up taking care of the problem for me. So
Wow. Yeah,
I never had to use violence for myself. There were others who used violence for me.
That's the way.
Which is actually one of my rules.
Yeah,
it's to let others do your dirty work.
Yeah, you should have told the Patriots player Hernandez that.
Yeah, seriously.
That's actually one thing. You know, when that case happened, I'm like, he should have learned from the Italians, man. You never get your hands dirty if you're, you know, on top of the food chain. Are you willing to share some of your other rules that are in the book that helped you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there were some that were tongue in cheek, like admit nothing, deny everything, make counter accusations.
Is that also for marriage?
Yeah, seriously. At the CIA, we had that on T-shirts and coffee mugs in the CIA gift shop, and it was kind of a joke. But it was a serious rule for me in prison. I used it a lot. And the most important ones really were, if calm is not to your benefit, chaos is your friend, or recruit spies to steal secrets or anything else you need, or trust no one. There was one that in the practical sense was probably the most important, and that was seek and utilize available cover. At the first sign of trouble, get out, get off the X, because everybody's going to get rounded up and everybody's going to go to solitary while the cops sort it out and do their investigation. So if you're just standing there watching two guys duke it out, you're going to go to solitary with them until the cops are satisfied that you didn't have something to do with that fight. So there were 20 of these rules, and I used each and every one of them.
Do you feel like it changed you a little bit, or, you know, being in that environment, or was it not that different than, you know, like
it changed me. I have a visceral distrust of our government. But on the good side, I'm far more patient than I ever was in the past. I'm far more accepting of people who are nothing at all like me. And I'm far more empathetic than I ever was in the past.
So your opinions of people who are in, I mean, there's a good book. I wish I this morning I actually was trying to think of the title, but it was a book about how every person commits three crimes on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's Three Felonies a Day by Harvey Silverglade.
Yep.
It's a really important book.
Yeah, and it kind of, and I've heard you say in interviews, you think everybody in prison is this awful person who deserves to be there. But I mean, there's a lot of people. I mean, there's going to be people who are in jail for weed when marijuana is legal everywhere, you know? I think we have to change our perspective on people in prison. And, you know, you talked about Clinton earlier in the show. I mean, their minimum sentencing, what, you know, three strikes, you're out, all that stuff. I mean, that stuff just filled up our prisons. And
It didn't make us any safer.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, how much of prison do you think is, you know, because obviously, I mean, what are we, like 5% of the world's population, and we're some ridiculous percentage?
25% of the world's prison population.
Yeah, that's crazy to think about how many. I mean, I've read statistics on, you know, they're talking about how there's more African Americans locked up today than there were African slaves, you know, and I mean, it's almost like it seems like a, and then you look at like the war on drugs, and I've had Adam Scorgi on who did the documentary, The Culture High, and it was all about the war on drugs and just the failed war on drugs. And I've had Rick Ross on who did time for selling cocaine, even though it was the CIA who was bringing it in. And,
yeah.
And so it seems like the whole war on drugs is really just a class warfare where it was just like, you know, the rich and the powerful just justifying locking up and actually in some cases making money off locking up minorities. And I mean, is that kind of what you is that accurate, you think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The system is racist. The system is xenophobic. The system is anti-poor. And to make matters even worse, they treat mental illness as a disciplinary problem rather than as a medical one. And so the prisons are and solitary confinement are full of people who are mentally ill and have no true appreciation for what they're doing in there.
Yeah, and I think I saw a Vice documentary some years ago about how they kind of stopped all the programs that help people with mental illnesses. So now, like you said, they just lock them up and there really isn't any help. There's, you know, there's nothing to kind of get them on their feet or get them the help that they need. And I mean, I think we have to start looking at a lot of things differently. We have to look at addicts also, like, you know, where I was born in Portugal, they decriminalized all drugs in 2001. And it was quite helpful in regards to lowering, saving money, because instead of locking everybody up for addiction, you're looking at it as it was a medical issue. And if you had more than what they considered a personal amount of any drug, then they would kind of analyze you and see if you needed help or not. But like you said, a lot of these things like mental illness, drug addiction, or all these things, we should look at as it's a health issue. It's a mental illness, it's a disease, and get them help, not so much like the criminals, because a lot of, even if they do commit crimes, I think it's a little different than somebody committing crime who's sane or doesn't have a disease that's fogging their perception or their motives or whatnot. And I think that, you know, when somebody robs a car, you know, because they trying to get more crack money, you know, then
yeah,
we have to look at it a little different than somebody who maybe robs a car for the sake of robbing a car, you know. I think,
yep.
This is a really interesting debate, because it's like, well, technically they're both committing crimes, and I guess are your now are we going to judge crimes based on motives, you know?
And sure.
So it becomes kind of a interesting conversation about it. But I think,
but you can judge based on motives, and that's what's wrong with mandatory minimum sentencing, because all it does, mandatory minimum really means maximum. So, you know, where one judge may give somebody 6 months and another judge may give somebody who committed the same crime 12 years, you create a mandatory federal minimum, and the mandatory minimum becomes the 12 years, not the 6 months. We see that with all kinds of drug cases. And just in the last week, Attorney General Sessions reinstituted the Bush administration's mandatory minimum policy and did away with the Obama administration's work to move away from mandatory minimums. So the prisons are just going to fill right back up again.
Yeah, and do you think we're going to head towards more private prisons?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt. And that's shameful, disgraceful.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
The only way for those prison companies to make money is to cut the amount of money they spend on food and medical services. So we think the conditions are bad now. You haven't seen anything yet. Wait till more and more people start dying in prison unnecessarily.
And there's going to be incentive for filling up the prisons. There's that documentary, was it Children for Cash, Cash for Children, whatever it was called, when they basically were locking up kids for like skipping class or being late to school just because there was a private juvie who was making money off filling, you know, keeping it full. So, yeah, I mean, when there's profit in that, and I think it was Colorado where one of the groups that were the most anti-legalizing marijuana was the correctional officer unions, you know, and it's like it does. You don't think about it, but like once you create a system where people are profiting off something, you know, and in this case, prisons, keeping prisons full, you know, then next thing you know, there's not really incentive in changing anything. People don't want to change things, so it's really interesting. But I know, John, you're a very busy guy. I know you were just on watching the Hawks just not too long ago. They just aired that episode yesterday, and it was cool to see you on there. And I've had Tabitha and Sean and Tyrell on a few times. So, but
good folks.
Yeah, awesome people. And you know, obviously Tyrell's a good guy because you got to love his dad, Jesse, very outspoken and
definitely.
Another guy who's not, ideology doesn't motivate his opinions and perspectives and stuff. So you got to love people like that. And so thank you so much. Your book is it out already? I know it's coming out in May.
Yeah, it came out Tuesday. Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison. Actually, right there.
There it is. Okay, awesome. And I'll have all the links in the show notes and the show description. I'll have the links to your website, to your book. I'm sure it's available on Amazon and everywhere books are available.
Oh, yeah.
And you've written, and that's not your first book, so you also have some other stuff that if people want to check out, you've written some other books. And thanks a lot, John. I mean, amazing story. Also check out the film Silence if people want to watch
It's on Netflix, Amazon, yep. iTunes, all over the place.
Yeah, and I think it really gives people a really good perspective of how personally and financially and in every way affects just trying to be honest and trying to be a good citizen, how they treat people who do that. And it's shameful, and I think when you can put faces and to the kids that are affected, the wives are affected, the people who are affected, I think it's hard not to sympathize with what you're going through. So and from my perspective, you guys are all heroes, and
thank you, and
I really appreciate what you guys do, and hopefully we need people like you and Ray McGovern and people who are outspoken and even Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who worked at the White House, who now is very outspoken. He's been on my show. Yeah, it's good because people who have been in the inside and out are outspoken. People are going to really respect your opinions and perspectives a little more than just an average Joe like myself stayed in it. So
thank
you so much, John. Hey, enjoy the rest of your weekend. And
we'll
reconnect soon.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks, John. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I believe in the ripoff.